welcome to our newest episode of the Lebanese Physicians Podcast. This is episode number 84. And in this episode, our guest is Dr. Anthony Wehbe, and we'll be discussing the future of healthcare at home or in the hospital or office. Is it? We don't know. And that's what we're going to discuss today. And the reason we're discussing this, Dr. Wehbe actually is an internal medicine physician by training. He trained at UMDNJ in New Jersey. He had an MBA actually prior to going into medical school, and he has since established Sena Health, which actually offers healthcare at home, in the workplace, and telehealthcare, which we'll discuss more during this episode. Welcome, Anthony, to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Khalil, for having me. I'm really excited to be here, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, Anthony, it was great to meet you and to have some discussions before the podcast today. And it looks like you grew up in the U.S. and you did in a couple of years of high school in Lebanon in the north, and then moved back here, did your undergrad and everything else. So that's how the Lebanese connection is, I guess. It's everywhere. Lebanese people are everywhere.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, my journey was a little unique. I was born in the U.S. and my father really wanted us to learn the culture and be close with our family. So I lived with my grandparents in Lebanon through middle school up until high school, and then came and finished high school back in the U.S., undergrad, medical school. So yeah, I have a lot of family still there, and my connections are very deep to Lebanon.
Excellent. Yeah, yeah. And that's, I mean, you speak good Arabic and stuff like that. So I think that's how you also made it better when you were there. So basically, Anthony, it looks like you were business oriented from the get-go, and you went into medical school, but then I guess you finished internal medicine at UMDNJ, but first you started your career as just a hospitalist, right?
Yeah, I'll share. I feel my journey was a little unique in the sense that I was a business and pre-med major before. So just like many Lebanese, a lot of people go into business. So that was in my DNA. Didn't really have any doctors or physicians in my family. And I really was attracted to the business world. It just came natural to me. So I started a marketing company before I even got my MBA. And then when I got my MBA, I didn't want to have any regrets in life. I was also a pre-med major. So I applied to medical school, got in, and that's how my healthcare journey started. I chose internal medicine because of the flexibility that it gave as a practicing physician. I really wanted to be a cardiologist, and I did everything to get into a fellowship. But my last year of internal medicine, I'm like, I'm done with training. I have to go out and work. And I started out as a hospitalist in internal medicine, but really practiced the whole gamut of internal medicine. I did some outpatient work, some nursing home work. I even did a little bit of telemedicine early on. I love technology. I'm a tech geek. And so really the whole gamut of internal medicine. But yeah, hospitalist was, you do 12, 14 shifts a month. It's full time. And I'm a workaholic. I love working. So I'm like, what am I going to do with the rest of my time? So I did other things in addition to being a hospitalist. And then when I accidentally, believe it or not, got into healthcare administration. So when I was a hospitalist, they saw a physician with a business background. So they asked me to attend different committees in the hospital, to be on different committees. And next thing I know, I was given some leadership roles. I'm one of those guys that if I see something wrong, I have to raise my hand, voice my opinion. And next thing I know, I'm on all these hospital committees. As a hospitalist, you're involved with everything. And then I got on different leadership roles like medical director, senior medical director, became a vice president and senior vice president at what was Jefferson Health in the Philadelphia area. Before that, I was at Kennedy Health. So yeah, kind of accidentally got into healthcare administration for around 2014, 2015 till about 2020.
And then I guess, yes, so that's your involvement and how you got into population health and right through your healthcare administration work.
Yeah, so back around 2014, 2015, this thing was coming up as population health. People were curious to what it was about. And our health system was looking into it. And I found it very intriguing and fascinating. So one of my titles over the years was Chief Population Health Executive. It was really an operational role but I was very fortunate to be able to work closely with the physician leaders, along with the operational leaders, and, you know, sat across the table from different payers in New Jersey, different population health. I learned a lot over. I'm a big believer in population health as an approach to improve the way we deliver high quality care, and did that for a few years.
We hear the term population health, but sometimes we don't know what it is exactly, I guess. But thanks for explaining it. And so in 2020, I guess, is when you decided to develop Senna Health. Or how did it come about that you developed Senna Health?
So, you know, after a few years of being in healthcare administration, I did some reflection and decided right before the pandemic, you know, I wanted to go out and do something on my own. And personally, when I, you know, as I reflected on what motivated me as a physician and what got me going, was really helping people age in place. That was the initial genesis of Senna. Wanted to create a company that help people age in place and leverage technology to meet people where they are. So, you know, I have aging parents myself, and I've always done everything to incorporate technology over the years to bring care to them. So that was the genesis of Senna. We started out during the pandemic in the New Jersey area. You know, we got hit hard with the pandemic. We were telling people, don't go to the emergency room, don't go to the hospital unless you're really, really sick. So we got a lot of referrals from community physicians of patients that didn't want to go to the hospital and get treated. So that was our first service line that we started out at Senna, was hospital at home, and essentially bringing hospital level services to people in their home. And that kind of took off for almost 4 years ago. And then from there, we've evolved into other care models outside of hospital at home. So that was the genesis of how we started Senna.
Yes. So basically, you started like during the pandemic when people were trying to avoid hospitals, and your idea was that yes, we instead of all the patients coming to the hospital and getting exposed to COVID or exposing others to COVID, I guess, then you can do hospital at home and treat them at their house. So can you describe to me like what does hospital at home entail? I guess like I imagine it as like getting IVs and nurses and whatever and telemedicine.
Sure. Yep. So it's not a new model of care, Khalil. This has been around for decades. And close to you in the DC area, actually at Hopkins, was one of the very first programs around the US. And there's been a lot of research and studies around this. After Hopkins, Mount Sinai around in 2015 got a large grant to develop the model. And from that came a research paper demonstrating and outlining the model. Around the world, when you look at other countries, especially in Europe, you have to be very, very sick to get admitted to the hospital. You know, in the US, there are many things that get admitted in the hospital that in other countries can be treated at home. So for hospital at home, these are general medical floor type patients that come into the hospital for an IV treatment, for monitoring, that because of the way technology has evolved can now be done in the home. And not just, it's affordable technology in the home. So the five most common diagnoses for this type of care is congestive heart failure, COPD, pneumonia, UTI, cellulitis. So as physicians, you know, these patients come in, a lot of them failed outpatient treatment. They come in for IV diuretics, for IV antibiotics, for broad spectrum coverage until some cultures come back. So these are the types of patients. These are not trauma patients. These are not ICU patients, not even telemetry level patients. However, Khalil, this can account for about 40%, depending on some studies that you look at, of what comes into a community hospital. So hospital at home, that's happening today in the country as an example, a patient shows up in the ER, let's take pneumonia, they failed outpatient treatment, you do a workup in the ER, you see the pneumonia, they need IV medications, they leave the hospital with devices. They get set up at home with a nurse. They have an IV, just like they would in a hospital. You hang IV antibiotics at home. You draw labs the next day. If you need any imaging, there can be portable x-rays, ultrasounds, echoes, Dopplers that can be done at home. The physician is typically virtual, and then the nurse is at the bedside. And the length of stay on average, 3 to 4 days, a little bit less than a typical brick and mortar hospital stay. And then they get discharged from home just like they would in a hospital setting. So yeah, this happens. It's got a lot of traction over the last few years in terms of delivering this high acuity care in the home. And then there are other models, Khadi. Like one of our programs is observation at home. So if you're, you know, if you're familiar with the hospital world, you know, some patients come in for observation, not full inpatient admission. We're doing observation at home for one of our hospital partners here in New Jersey, as an example. Those are typically lower acuity type patients that just need monitoring and observation. Length of stay is about a day or two, just like they would in a hospital. But now we can do that at home.
Yeah, but basically my imagination is you get these people to the ER. They have to, what if they need like oxygen? So if they need oxygen or IV fluids, you can give them at home too, right? That's what you're doing too at the same time.
That's exactly right. So we do oxygen at home, but now there's specific criteria. There's studies now showing risk stratifying patients, having specific inclusion and exclusion criteria, both clinical and social criteria to get admitted into the home. But like you mentioned, oxygen, yeah, we do oxygen at home. Some of our programs, they cut off, you know, if you require more than 3 liters, then they would admit you to the hospital. If it's 2 liters of oxygen, it's something that's needed short term to get them through that acute stage. We do that at home today. So they leave the hospital with oxygen and we give them oxygen in the home, just like we would in a general medical floor.
Great, yeah. So it's just like you draw the line. Let's say somebody needs to be on pressors or medications that keep the blood pressure up. Critically ill patients need to be in a step-down unit or an ICU level setting and not at home.
That's exactly right, Khalil. And the problem, you know, America faces as a country is with the growing population and the rising cost of care, it's going to be hard to have enough hospital beds to care for people in the country. Right. An average hospital bed can cost anywhere from $2 to $3 million per bed, depending if it's, you know, are we talking, you know, suburbia, Pennsylvania or San Francisco as an example. So a hospital can cost anywhere $200-300 million. I mean, there are some hospitals that are in the billions now. I can even speak in the Philadelphia area. With an aging population, it's going to be hard to catch up and care for the growing population. So there's a lot of discussions and predictions that the hospital of the future will be trauma centers, intensive care units, and step down telemetry floors. These general medical floor patients can be treated at home. I was just in Florida last week. There are standalone emergency rooms now that can do a whole lot and are very efficient than a traditional ER in a hospital. So there's a lot of, you know, discussions and experts saying that the hospital of the future will be ICUs, trauma centers, obviously operating rooms as well for urgent surgeries, and then step down or telemetry units. So all these general medical floor type patients can be cared for in the home and observation.
Right, exactly. Be more geared towards the critically ill patients, not to the general medical floor patients.
That's exactly right.
So my next question for you is are these services covered by Medicare or other private insurers?
So one of the biggest, you know, instrumental things that happened over the last 4 years during the pandemic was Medicare passed the hospital at home Medicare waiver. So November of 2020 is when Medicare started paying for hospital at home. Any hospital in the country can apply, establish a hospital at home program, and Medicare will pay for hospital at home. Out of the, you know, 5,000-6,000 hospitals in the US today, there's about 320 hospitals that have Medicare approval for payment. So we've done that. We've helped hospitals get their Medicare approval for hospital at home programs. There are commercial payers also paying, like a lot of Medicare Advantage programs around the country outside of Medicare. So these are private commercial payers that are also paying for hospital at home. One thing, and I think this is where the future is headed as well, in order to mitigate the cost of healthcare, is now some insurances, some private insurances are paying for hospital level care outside of the hospital. So a patient comes to an outpatient doctor's office, or they're in an oncology's office, and they failed outpatient treatment for their pneumonia UTI infection. There's objective criteria that we can determine on the outpatient end, right? You look at labs, you look at imaging, and say objectively, this person has a pneumonia diagnosis. They failed outpatient treatment. Now they need IV antibiotics. We can admit them from the doctor's office, from the outpatient, directly into an acute care at home episode. So that reduces your cost, reduces the overcrowding in the ERs. A lot of ERs around the country are under-resourced and overcrowded with a lot of things that can be handled on the outpatient end. So there's a movement towards that as well in terms of paying for this type of service.
Right, I agree. I mean, like last time I had a friend who had to go to the ER, and she was frustrated saying that she had to wait like 12 hours for somebody to see her for a simple complaint. And that's common. You hear it from a lot of people. They go to the ERs, they're overcrowded. They want to try to risk stratify patients and get the sicker patients in. So you get people for regular complaints waiting very long periods of time to get in.
Unfortunately, Khalil, that's a daily issue that happens around the country. A lot of these ERs are also understaffed. Staffing is a huge concern. There isn't a week that doesn't go by that I don't read an article about that. Actually, I think I read an article recently, the state of Massachusetts is looking to declare a state of emergency because of the number of overcrowdedness in the ER. And a lot of what gets handled in the ERs, this is outside of hospital level care at home, about half, give or take, can be handled in an outpatient office.
Right, right.
That shows up in the ER. It's a matter of access to care.
Yeah, basically outpatient office or somebody going to the home and assessing the patient there rather than them coming to the outpatient office or the ER in that case.
That's exactly right. Or urgent cares or standalone ERs, outpatient urgent cares. Yeah. You know, what really works in the way we describe our services, Khalil, is healing at home. The way we look at it, it's a whole spectrum of care in the home. It can be hospital level care in the home. It can be post-op care in the home. It can be observation in the home, or even getting rehab and physical therapy in the home, all the way to, you know, advanced primary care in the home, being able to deliver certain services to people in the home. And a patient's home can be their house in the community, their apartment. It can be a nursing home. It can be a group home, assisted living, independent living. People now, you know, work from home. So is their home their workplace or is it their home? So the lines have been blurred, but the whole point is to bring care to people where they are. You know, that gig economy concept of, you know, you can DoorDash things, you can Uber things to your home. Why not do it with healthcare? You know, you keep sick people away from other sick people. You're able to deliver now with technology. You're able to deliver that into the home. So that's why our company at Senna has evolved over the years. Like at the core of what we're doing is this 24/7, 365 clinical command center. So it's this clinical command center that heavily leverages technology. We have our own tech team, both onshore and offshore, that we build our own tech, and we can deliver on hospital at home, post-op care at home, observation at home. During the pandemic, we were bringing vaccines to people in their home, you know, but it all revolves around this command center that's 24/7 service to people.
And this command center, that's for hospital at home and for care at home, but also, is it for like monitoring, like say, like diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, whatever, like other, or COPD or CHF, like do you monitor people chronically, let's say outpatients, to prevent them from coming into the hospital?
So we work with a lot of medical groups here in the New Jersey area, where some of our programs are just simple, what we call remote patient monitoring and chronic care management, right? So a medical practice has a group of diabetics, a group of hypertensive patients, COPD, and, you know, they want to check their blood pressure is uncontrolled. They want to monitor their blood pressure. Literally, they, you know, take a device from the office. It's all cellular connected. They can literally be in a parking lot. They can be, you know, just take the device with them. It's all by cellular. They check their, you know, glucometer, their glucose readings, and we get it. We monitor it here in our command center. Each of our programs functions in a pod. So we describe, you know, a pod for, you know, one of our customers that does hospital at home, another pod that does remote patient monitoring or continuous care management. Another one, we actually work with employers as well. So we monitor employers, we help them navigate care through our clinical command center. But yeah, we do everything from hospital level care, setting up hospital level care, delivering hospital level care, all the way to simple monitoring glucometers for diabetics in the home.
So when you monitor, I'm going to get to the employer part in just a bit, but when you monitor diabetics, hypertensives, so you have people who monitor, because sometimes what I worry about in these situations is you get so many abnormal values or values that are out of range. And do you notice all of those? And what if you don't notice them? What would happen?
So great, great question, Khalil. That's why in any program like this, yes, could human error happen? Sure. But if you have the appropriate technology and checks and balances in place, you shouldn't have any errors or misreadings. Our command center runs 24/7, 365. And there's always monitoring by a human being, but also by technology, right? You have to make sure you have a list. Right now, I can pull up a list and say, okay, here's the 10 people that are out of range. And you're right, there is a human error that can happen when someone's checking their blood pressure. Did they do it after they went up the steps? Did they not sit down, you know, wait a couple of minutes, have their arm at, you know, heart level and check their blood pressure that way? So if someone's out of range for a blood pressure reading, as an example, we have a workflow where we call them, we ask them, can you recheck your vital signs, recheck your blood pressure? And almost half the time, you're right, it just wasn't done correctly and it's a normal reading. When it's confirmed that it's abnormal, then we follow the workflow and call the physician, the provider for that specific program and escalate it based on workflows.
Do you leverage artificial intelligence in this?
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate that my brother, my younger brother, has a master's degree in AI from the University of Toronto, and he started an AI company 6 years ago, before AI was a popular thing. So he helps companies around the world. I told you he moved back to Lebanon, so he does a lot of work in the Khalij area, and he was just in Saudi and Dubai, helping companies develop their AI strategy. So I get the brother discount, the brother support. So he helped us from day one develop our AI strategy. Because we have a ton of data. So we have, you know, RPM data, we have recorded phone calls, text messages, we have a lot of data. So the very first step is to structure your data, make sure your data is structured, and then from there, incorporating AI. So our AI is used internally now to make our coordinators, we say, twice as effective. We want our center coordinator to be twice as effective, leveraging tech, which includes AI, to do their best work. We don't have anything that's, you know, patient or family facing yet, that's down the line, God willing. But for now, we're using AI internally to help our coordinators work more efficiently.
Excellent. And now let's pivot to employer healthcare, so in the workplace, or healthcare in the workplace. So how are you assisting employers with that? And as a thing, I've talked once, I did a podcast actually with a startup in Toronto, and they were actually providing AI-based mental health for employees in the workplace. So that's interesting that people are starting to pivot towards that. So what are the services that you offer employers?
Yeah, so I told you when we started Senna 4 years ago, we started out in the hospital at home space during the pandemic, helping people age in place, bringing care to people in the home. And one of my clients is one of the largest group home operators. I don't know if you're familiar with group homes. It's caring for people with intellectual disabilities. They're one of the largest group home operator in the Philadelphia tri-state area, so PA, New Jersey, Delaware. And in working with them, within 3 months, Khalil, we reduced their ER utilization by 60%. So again, we were able to deliver care on site, bring care to them. So their CEO and their chief clinical officer was so impressed and said, Dr. Wahbi, can you present to our board and tell them about this great outcomes that we have? So I went to their board meeting, their annual board meeting, and I knew one of their board members that worked at my former health system there. So as I presented to them, you know, one of them raised their hand and said, Dr. Wahbi, can you help us with our employees? We have 3,500 employees. A lot of them use the ER like it's primary care, but just like many other companies, our cost of care is going up and up. And our second light item expense after salaries is healthcare expense, which is a thing that almost every company in the US faces, even my own company. You know, healthcare is very expensive for our own staff. So of course I said, yes, we're gonna do it. And we took a few months to develop a program for employers. And we took a proactive approach where an employee will give us 10, 15, 20 minutes. If they wanna enroll their whole family, you know, we book an appointment for like, you know, an hour if we need to. We do an intake call with them, Khalil, where they do an intake with our clinical command center. We know all their history, we know their healthcare goals, we know their wellness goals. You know, at a certain age, they have to do their colonoscopy, their mammogram, all their preventative care. We come up with a plan, right? We include them in our HIE. So there's a local health information exchange network here. If they hit any of the ERs or utilize healthcare here, we get a ping notification. So we really become their first call. So anything related to their healthcare, to their wellness, they call us first before they even think of going to the ER, think of going to an urgent care, and we help them navigate. We say, I give this example, you know, someone, let's say they have an orthopedic issue where, you know, they hurt their leg or they hurt their back. Their first thing they want to do is go to an ER, right? So the company we're working with, as an example, has a telemedicine offering. So we connect them with a telemedicine doc and they say, no, you need to see an orthopedic surgeon to get evaluated. If you go to the ER, you're going to see a general ER physician. There's not going to be an orthopod there waiting to evaluate you. You're going to get a $1 million workup. I love my ER colleagues, but you know, everyone gets an extensive workup in the ER. So instead of going to the ER, and you know, that ER visit can be 3, 4, 5,000, sometimes more, we get them to a orthopedic urgent care, as an example here, where they get an orthopedic evaluation and they get a workup, they save the cost from an ER, and now it's an urgent care visit and they get tied into the system. We have examples of people in the hospital that, you know, they have a major surgery. They're told that, you know, you need to go to a rehab for X amount of time. Well, the patient doesn't want to be at rehab. They want to be at home with their family. So we're able to bring home health to them. We're able to bring care to them in the home. It's a lower cost setting. So we have a lot of stories like this where we've been able to show a 4-to-1 ROI for these employers, where if they spend $1 on Senna, they get $4 back in investment, because we're doing simple things and helping patients avoid unnecessary care, get the right care, experience healthcare in a better way. Our patient satisfaction scores are very high by proactive navigation. So that's how I describe our services. It's really proactive navigation to help employees navigate care. So it's been a fun journey here, Khalil, in helping, you know, employers do the right thing. They end up saving money. They end up giving their employees a better healthcare experience. So it's been a really win-win all around in working with employers.
And just for people to know, like the cost savings come from potentially insurance premiums, let's say, going down because the employees are healthier or are not requiring as much hospital-based or ER-based services.
That's exactly right. And also getting them to do their preventative care, you know, getting their annual visits, getting their screening mammograms and colonoscopies, to avoid a catastrophic event. So that's where we come in. And by the way, a lot of employers are offering a lot of great solutions, a lot of point solutions. like remote patient monitoring, telemedicine. And there is what's they're calling in the space now point solution fatigue, you know? So people, employees don't know who to call, what to call when they need healthcare. So now we become a solution for that, where Senna is your first call. You call us if you're, you know, looking to find a cardiologist, looking for an infertility doctor, or looking to lose weight and go to a gym, you know? To the point, Khalil, I was going to make that one of our customers is incentivizing their employees by giving them a payroll addition. So they're paying their staff to sign up with Senna. So for them, because they see the return on investment by investing in preventative care, in care navigation. So by paying their employees to sign up with Senna, they're actually saving money.
And have you published this data in terms of like cost savings and stuff like that?
Yeah, so working on that, you know, as a, you know, we're 4 years into this journey as a company. We have a ton of data. So I've engaged, I'm on medical staff here at a medical school, Rowan, here in New Jersey. So I'm volunteer faculty. I do some lectures there for their medical school. So trying to get some residents and staff to help us with our research and publications now that we have a lot of data around this. But we have some case studies published that, you know,
About it.
With data.
And one of them, my last question is like staffing for you, because when you look at hospitals, let's say you go to a hospital, you have one nurse to six patients on a general medical ward, let's say. But when you do a hospital at home, you have one nurse to one patient, and there's deficiency of nurses. So do you have any problems finding staffing for your patients?
It's a great, great question, Khalil, because that's one of the misconceptions there is, yes, just like you have a 1-to-6 ratio in an inpatient general medical floor, we use that same ratio, believe it or not. A nurse can see 6 to 7 patients. You know, you map it out geographically to make sure that they're efficient. They spend anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour with patients. Remember, patients are consistently connected to the command center. So if they have a simple question or their family has a question about, oh, labs, when's the doctor coming? When's my ultrasound being done? When's the pulmonologist visit going to happen? You don't need a nurse to answer that question, you know? So they're constantly connected to the command center. The nurse goes in to do nursing functions, like, you know, administer medications and answer nursing questions that the patient has. So the ratio actually works out on the outpatient end, sorry, on the hospital at home, and as it does on the inpatient end as well. And then at night, you don't need as many nursing because you really want people to sleep. You know, we do a really good job. Look, I was a hospitalist for many years. People come into the hospital and they get no sleep, you know. We order Q6, Q8 hours labs and vitals, and you know, we keep going in there to wake them up. So at home, you really want them to sleep at night. You want them to rest, to heal, especially the elderly patients with dementia. So at night, you actually have lesser nursing, you know, needs. And we try to move the med we try to make the medications you know, like Q daily or Q 12 hours. Sometimes we'll do Q8, but try not to. So that way the interventions are not, you know, too intrusive to the patient. So at night they're really resting. And believe it or not, you know, there's been a lot of burnout of hospital staff. I know a lot of my hospitalist friends, physicians, nurses, they're attracted to this model of care at home because it's different. It gets them out of the hospital. There's been a lot of pressure on people that have worked in the hospital for through the pandemic over the last 4 years. So people are very intrigued with this model. And yeah, we've been very fortunate to be able to attract some talented people.
Right. And yeah, that was my next question for you, actually, like the composition of your staff. I think you have nurses, probably MDs, nurse practitioners, right? Or what's the composition of your staff monitoring patients?
So yes, we have RNs that do the bedside nursing and administer medications in the home. We utilize a lot of nurse practitioners We have a couple of PAs and then physicians with oversight. So really everyone working to the top of their license, everyone has their own role. We recruit from the inpatient world because there's a common misconception that, oh, you know, why don't you use home health, you know? So this is not home health. There's a role and function for home health. Home health is really a nursing driven function. You know, when a patient comes into the hospital, it's a physician or provider driven function with, you know, orders being placed, follow-up being placed, daily physician visits being done, oversight of that patient. It's very, very different than home health. We've recruited some home health nursing and staff, but we really prefer to get staff from the inpatient world, so ICU, ER, and hospitalist world.
Hospital. And do you see like this model starting to flourish in other countries outside of the US, or is it just US-based at this time?
Yeah, so I believe other countries are ahead of us in how long they've been doing hospital at home. So last year, we were very fortunate last April of last year of 23 to present in Barcelona. So there's the World Hospital at Home Conference. It's been happening for the last few years, and we were there last year presenting. It's incredible what other countries are doing. Now, it's very different payment models in other countries. It's not as complicated as the US when it comes to insurance. But I think where the US is moving forward ahead of other countries is in leveraging the technology and the investments going into care at home, hospital at home, in order for it to be scalable. Because look, any hospital can see, you know, 5-10 patients, but in order to scale it and have a census of 20, 30, 40, 50 patients, you really need to have the technology, the clinical command center, just like you would any service line. You really need to invest in that infrastructure to grow it. So I think the US is moving ahead with the technology, with the scalability. But in other countries, they've been doing hospital at home, like in Australia and the UK, they've been doing hospital at home way longer than the US because of their payment models, because of their, you know, different payment models.
Right, because it's a completely different payment model in these countries. So you cannot extrapolate the data or cost savings that they have and compare it to the US because it's a completely different payment model. But you can probably say, all right, there's going to be cost savings, but it might be different or at a higher scale in the US, at a bigger scale in the US, I guess, than in these countries.
So, yeah, so look, the US healthcare cost is the highest in the world. We all know that. It's the largest pharmaceutical market in the world. So it's very expensive care that's delivered here. But when you extrapolate data, like in Australia, for example, over the last few years, they've shifted about 10 to 15% of what used to go into the hospital. They're doing it now in the home, as an example. You know, now some might say that's a low number, but when you add, you know, the number of hospitalizations, the number of visits, the millions of people that get admitted in the US, that number can be pretty high. McKinsey actually did a really good white paper around this, examining other countries' programs and then extrapolating some US data from that. But as time moves along now, Khalil, there's tons of studies coming out. The NIH sponsored a study 2 months ago that was done at Mass General that showed tremendous outcomes in a hospital at home program. There was a JAMA article from October with 11,000 patients. The study from January had about 5,000. So there's a lot of studies coming out now as this is gaining momentum.
Right, excellent. And where do you see the future of healthcare? I mean, we discussed it a bit earlier, but where do you see the future of healthcare heading? Because some people say, all right, telemedicine is gaining traction, and some other people and other companies say, no, see your patients in the clinic. So what are your thoughts? Will patients keep coming to clinics, or will patients shift or pivot towards telemedicine and telehealthcare?
So I get asked this question all the time about, telemedicine and how it can impact care. I look at telemedicine as a tool, just like a stethoscope, just like a screening colonoscopy. It's a tool in how we deliver care. So there are some things that are very appropriate for telemedicine, and there are some things that are no way appropriate at all for telemedicine because of the limitations. I know some practices like endocrinologists that have shifted their whole practice to virtual care using telemedicine. Psychiatry, as another example, you can do that virtually. But when you need to palpate the patient, when you need to intervene, there are limitations of telemedicine. So I look at it as a tool. Now, I think we're very behind in healthcare in leveraging technology in general, telemedicine specifically. So that's why you've seen since the pandemic that a lot of telemedicine has picked up over the last few years. So I think there'll be more in telemedicine. I think more care will shift into lower cost settings, just like when you look at historically surgeries. In the 70s, there were no ambulatory surgical centers. It took a few years to get there. Now most surgeries happen in ambulatory surgical centers. When you look at urgent cares, years ago there was no urgent cares. Everything went to the ER. Now you have urgent cares on every corner. Things don't go to the ER anymore. They go to urgent cares. So I think same thing will happen with hospitals, just because we're not going to have enough hospitals to care for people. So certain things will be cared for in the outpatient setting, in the home setting, leveraging technology, and telemedicine being one of them. The hardware devices, now we're able to monitor people. For example, one of the devices we use is a patch that sits on the chest. It can measure cardiac output, heart rate, temperature, and costs $120 as an example, So technology is evolving, the cost of tech is evolving. I think using technology to make physician life easier, whether it's documentation and spending less time documenting and more time with patients, I think that's going to be a game changer as well. So in my world here, Khalil, I think making care more convenient for patients, leveraging technology, and moving more care into the home is where I see the future happening. Now, it takes time to change behavior in healthcare for many reasons, right? You don't want to experiment on people. You want to make sure it's safe and high quality. So, I think, God willing, in the next few years, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you're going to see more of momentum of shifting for multiple reasons. The cost of care going up, patients asking for more convenient care, and physicians, clinicians, being more comfortable with technology. So I think all those dynamics will impact the way we deliver care.
Right. I think it's similar to like DoorDash, let's say, when people used to go do their own groceries and stuff like that. And now more and more people are starting to say, all right, there's DoorDash, there's Instacart, there's others, and we can order our stuff to come to the house. We save time, we save effort. And similar thing, I think, with healthcare. Why go see a doctor if it's just a follow-up appointment on labs and stuff like that? So I guess
That's
I'm not going
exactly.
to ask you this, but I think you believe that the future of Sana Health is going to be growth and more healthcare at home, and more companies, whether it's hospitals or employers, wanting to work with you to have better access to healthcare and cost savings for their employees or for their patients.
Yeah, that's so, people ask me, what does Senna do? We do hospital at home, we take care of employees. We do post-op care in the home, observation at home. But really what we're doing here, Khalil, is truly transforming the healthcare experience. And the way we do that is by bringing care to people, meeting them where they are, leveraging technology. So we are hyper-focused on our clinical command center doing that really, really well, and continue to build on our technology, continue to build on our services. Even though we're a tech services company, I tell our staff, like, we are also high touch. I can't expect my elderly mother to download an app or to, you know, she doesn't even like texting, but, you know, pick up the phone and talk to her, you know. You have to be high tech, but also high touch in order, especially for the elderly population. So, yeah, that's what we're hyper-focused on doing that clinical command center service very, very well, working with hospitals, working with medical groups, working with employers, in order to deliver, you know, this type of care and meeting people where they are. We're looking to work with insurance companies and payers as well, because we feel we can make an impact there. So we have some ongoing discussions in that space. What I'm really proud of, I know this is the Lebanese Physician podcast. You know, Senna is a multinational company. Senna is an acronym for all the continents in the world. We truly have a global team at Senna. We have our tech development team, for example, in South Africa. We have a team for our back-end office actually in Lebanon. We also have a team in the Philippines. So we really try to recruit the best talent. Obviously, we have we have two offices here in Philadelphia for redundancy in New Jersey and in Philadelphia. So we have multiple offices there and really proud of bringing this global team to you know, truly transform healthcare. So it's been a fun journey. It's been the hardest I've ever worked, Khalil. being a hospitalist and a physician is not easy, but it's very much rewarding work.
Right, because now you want to make sure your company succeeds, and that takes a lot of work to build it from the ground up. Anthony, good. This was a great discussion and great work. I mean, developing Senna and moving it forward, and hopefully we'll hear a lot more about the company in the future.
Thank you, Khalil. We have a great team at Senna. I'm really proud of the team members that we have, and really kudos to you on doing this podcast. I love listening to the show and bringing the Lebanese community all over the world together on here. So I appreciate you inviting me over. Thank you.
Thank you for being on the podcast, Anthony.